topic so titillating that Penny couldn't recall any of them save one. Sam. Penny counted the minutes until the Celeste show was over and she could call him. She'd have to pretend to write or study until Jude fell asleep or take the call outside. He'd distinctly said he was going to call her, which indicated it was also a green light to call him. It wasn't as if they worried about who texted who last, so interface rules likely applied to calls, too. "I wish he'd confide in me," said Jude, reaching over her to snag a piece of salmon from her mom's plate. Penny marveled at how quickly her roommate and her mother had progressed to the food-sharing stage of their relationship. "He looks terrible, and he keeps blowing me off. I don't think he's eating or sleeping. I hope it's not drugs." Penny didn't think Sam looked terrible at all. In fact, he looked dreamy. Perfect. She hadn't known he wore glasses, and Penny was crazy about glasses as a thing. They were so much better than contacts. Why touch your own eyeballs when you could accessorize your face? So what now? If Sam had called and Penny had doubled down and seen him in person, even if it was an accident, what did this mean? Everything was messy now. It was all Jude and Celeste's fault. Why hadn't Sam called? They left house 3 hours ago. "Maybe it's a girl," said Celeste, pouring another round of sake. Penny's mom didn't think the tiny cups qualified as underage drinking. Jude clinked her glass to Celeste, then Penny's, and downed it. "Maybe," said Jude. "His ex is insane." She pulled out her phone. "Whatever's making him so withdrawn has to do with her. Get a load of this." Jude pulled up Ms. Lola XO. Penny had taken great pains not to search for Sam's ex after the last time, but if someone else was cruise directing. "Wait, stop." Celeste took control of the phone. "There's a video." Penny held her breath. She had no idea how she'd missed it. It was Sam peering into the camera. The background was noisy with voices and music, a party. He was smiling, slowly, sexily. He took a sip of beer and leaned in.
"What did I tell you?" said Video Sam.
"What?" objected a girl's voice off screen. "Why do you get to do it if I can't?" she asked. He grabbed the phone and held it aloft, the two of their heads framed in selfie mode. He had dark hair and dark eyes. Her hair was practically white and her eyes were pale. They were beautiful together.
"Happy?" he asked.
She smiled and nodded. With his other hand, he grabbed her chin and kissed her roughly.
"Jesus."
"See, they were like so goals," said Jude solemnly.
"No wonder he's preoccupied," said Celeste. "I don't think you get over this type of a girl."
Celeste ordered another sake.
"I bet she's mean," said Penny, apropos of nothing.
Well, nothing other than how Jude and Celeste were practically pulling her guts out of her butt and making friendship bracelets with them.
"That kind of girl only gets more desirable the meaner they are," said Celeste. She sighed dramatically. "I can't believe I'm turning 40.
Penny glared at her mother. She knew what Celeste was thinking. She was comparing herself to Lola. Any talk of desirable women reminded her mother of herself. What was that like? After dinner, Celeste dropped Jude off and took Penny to get ice cream at Amy's for some alone time.
"I love Jude," said Celeste.
She parked, and they walked toward the state capitol with their cones. It was beautiful when it was lit up at night. Downright romantic.
"She's so pretty and funny," she continued.
"Everyone loves Jude," said Penny, "and she loved you. I think she's serious about coming to your birthday party."
"Oh, good," she said. "I hope you're coming, too."
Penny rolled her eyes. "Mom," she said, "of course I'm coming." Penny knew she was being a jerk, except Celeste could be so extra with her neediness.
"Well, I hope so," Celeste said. "You haven't been home since you got to school. We've talked maybe twice in 2 months."
"7 weeks." Penny bit into her sorbet angrily.
She wished her mom would go home. She wished her mom hadn't come and forced her to see Sam at her ugliest and mentioned her freaking boyfriend when she knew nothing about anything and then bulldozed her into watching that video.
You know what I mean, said Celeste. It hurts my feelings. I was worried. You go days without calling me back. Not a peep. I mean, you lucked out with Jude. I'm less worried to know that you're living with a girl who's so social and sweet, seeing as you can be so...
What, Mom? Antisocial and poisonous? Penny shouted, proving her mom's point. She stomped up the Capitol stairs ahead of her.
That's not what I said.
Penny watched her mom eye her dessert for the perfect bite, and she could tell by her distracted expression that Celeste was liable to say something truly offensive. Penny stared at the shimmering city. If you looked straight down Congress from the front of the Capitol, everything was arranged in a perfect cross. Penny wondered if the bats were out.
It's just that your thing, you know, that thing you do can be tough in these situations, she said. Alienating. You're either talking a mile a minute with these $10 words or your eyes are darting all over the place. I know you didn't have a lot of friends in high school, and lately, I don't know, baby. And what's going on with you and Mark? Last week, he posted a picture of him and another girl.
Penny walked away and threw her cone in the trash. Her foul mood worsened. Pictures of Mark?
Well, honey, he and I are Facebook friends, said Celeste. Now, I know you don't love that, but I'd called so many times and texted and I wanted to know how things were.
Celeste touched her arm with an outrageously sappy expression.
Is he cheating on you? I messaged him to say hi and gather intel, and you know, he never wrote me back. Is everything okay between you two?
Celeste licked her cone again. She had sushi seaweed stuck in her front tooth. Penny couldn't believe her mom had the gall to message her ex-boyfriend. It was mortifying. Celeste was out of control, and Sam still hadn't called. Not even a text. Penny had never been more frustrated in her entire life. So, of course, she burst into tears.
Sam. Sam opened his eyes. His phone was lodged between his cheek and his mattress, optimally positioned for face cancer transmission. He grabbed it. The screen was black and inert. He lifted his cumbersome, seemingly sand-filled head to see where his charger was. The room swung. His eyes narrowed on the tiny white cube clear across the floor. It might as well have been in Guam. Never mind that plugging the cord into the tiny hole on his phone would be about as easy as refueling a jet engine in mid-flight. "Why?" he asked the empty room. He wished someone would at least come over and turn out his light. Maybe pass him the bottle of wild turkey that he'd left by the door. Actually, no. He didn't want that at all. His phone was dead. At least he noticed when his phone died. If Sam died, no one would care. He rolled onto his back and closed his eyes while the room sloshed around him. Thank God he was home. He might have been an idiot, but at least he'd had the foresight to keep his freakout contained. He took off his shirt, then kicked off his stiff pants like a petulant child. Sam wanted to take a bath. Actually, what he needed was someone to bathe him. It was still dark out, and the streets were quiet. Sam stood up, steadying himself against the wall as the blood flooded out of his head. He grabbed his towel and pushed off the wall by the mattress and stumbled to lean on the wall by the charger. He was an inelegant trapeze artist, Spider-Man, three sheets to the wind. It took him a few tries before he eventually got his phone set up. The thing about living where you work is that calling in sick was tricky business. So far, he hadn't attempted it. For a while, he'd call in a couple of times a month, or else have to stick his toothbrush down his throat to expel some of the liquor before going in still drunk. That hadn't happened since he'd moved in. Al hadn't made any sweeping declarations about rules, but as with everything with Al, they were implied. Keep your nose clean, and don't bother him. Sam tipped his head up and gawped at the popcorn stucco before grabbing the doorframe for support. He wondered if there was asbestos in the ceiling, silently killing him. It would serve him right, mooching off Al like this. A hot tear slid down his cheek. So that was it. He and Lorraine were properly over. Huzzah and good night. As he'd learned yesterday, and bless any day that you learn something new, there was such a thing in the world as a chemical pregnancy, a knocked-up limbo. There'd been enough hormones, HCG, Sam had researched it later, in Lorraine's pee to trip a few sticks, and that was it. Lyre had miscarried only technically, since she'd only been phantom pregnant. When she waltzed into the coffee shop to deliver this fascinating science lesson, she appeared unequivocally euphoric. She'd known for 4 days and stayed for exactly 40 seconds and had thought to tell him in person solely because she had a hair appointment next door. It took almost a week for her to tell him. That was how much he factored into any of this. They'd only briefly been parents to a teeny tiny smudge of a suicidal sea monkey. Yet Sam felt bereft. He'd been tense for weeks waiting for an answer, and when he knew definitively, his profound relief spiraled into a type of mourning. So he got wasted. He catapulted from the bedroom wall to his most death-defying act of bravery yet, to hurtle down the entire length of the hallway and into the bathroom. The air in the bathroom felt cool. He clung to the sink with both hands and rewarded himself with a long slug of water, which he promptly heaved into the toilet along with the battery acid that bourbon turns into after you toss half a bottle of it down your throat. Late period count. -5 days. Or was it 6? Days it would take to get over Lorraine, this time. 28. Or maybe 56, to be safe. Days it would take Sam to stop hating himself for drinking again. 2 million. Sam ran the tub and sat in it. The heat prickled, an army of pins and needles on his skin. The sun was coming up. The water rose around his bony arms and hollowed stomach, and in the muted light he decided he was ugly. Decorating his skeletal figure with tattoos perhaps hadn't been the best idea. God, he was depressed. Sam couldn't recall the last time he felt joy for any number of days he could string together. He pictured himself at Lorraine's birthday dinner 2 years ago, a potluck with enchiladas, and the fight they'd had for no reason other than being so shit-faced off fireball shots because there were no mixers and zero ice. When April got her GED last summer, they'd had her graduation at the bar. And for Labor Day, when Gash got alcohol poisoning on a tubing trip, they'd dropped him off at the clinic and continued drinking. Sam thought about how it felt to talk to Penny, and how dark their darks got sometimes. Emergency Penny. Wednesday, October 18, 2:13 a.m. Do you ever feel dead? Tired? No. Deceased. No. What? Sorry, I've been having the craziest dreams. Me too. You first. OMG, and it was a death dream. I was buried alive. Textbook anxiety nightmare. It wasn't a nightmare, though. Not really. I wasn't scared. I was in this coffin. Someone knew that I was still alive because there was this IV of blood that was dripping into my mouth. Well, that's just a tube. Doesn't count as an IV. You're the worst. LOL. It's true. Fine. A tube. I must have been a vampire because it was nourishment, and there was also this tube of oxygen pumping in. Complicated setup. All I know is that I could breathe. Wait. Someone you knew buried you, but was keeping you alive? Exactly. Interesting. And the crazy thing is, I think it was you. Why, though? You must have deserved it. It was strangely comforting. Are you harboring any desires to bury me? Not yet. Ha ha. KK, back to my thing. Do you know what Cotard's syndrome is? That was the first time he'd heard of it. Penny was a trove of oddities and inexplicable phenomena. Cotard's syndrome, or Cotard's delusion, was a rare mental illness where the afflicted person was convinced they were dead. French neurologist Jules Cotald had first described it as the delirium of negation. Sam pictured someone in a monocle saying, "No, no, no, no," while cackling hysterically. In an early case, a woman had believed that as a corpse she no longer needed food. Unsurprisingly, she died of starvation. Sam wiped his wet face with both hands. He rewound the tape to before he saw Lorraine. Penny's face when she'd come in with her mom. There. Stop. Sam had been happy then. He hadn't been thinking about Lorraine at all. He hadn't been worried or angry. His brain wasn't gnawing on his 1,000 failings or the people in his life he'd disappointed most. He was simply enjoying how the person he liked best, the one who usually lived inside his phone, walked over to ask for almond milk. And then Lorraine swooped in, scrambling his receptors. Right before his shift ended. Again ruining a rare moment he was completely in repose. As she left, she told him to keep her computer, or to donate it to charity. As if he would ever be in the position to give away something so valuable. Sam was gutted. Everything was falling apart again. Hands numb and head throbbing, Sam closed up shop, pulled himself an espresso, and then another. He sat on the porch swing with his sneakered feet dragging on the boards, heart thundering in time to his thoughts. What was this feeling, this loss? He felt hollow and bruised, scraped out from the inside. Sam moved to the steps, hitched his elbows on his knees, and let his head hang. "You do not get to have a panic attack because you're not having a baby," he told himself. Still, he was wrecked. The irrational hope died, the baseless idea that a baby would have somehow helped, that its appearance would mend at least part of what was damaged about his life. He'd get a do-over. The next chapter could begin. It would be new. Not perfect, but different. In his days, he'd heard Finn say goodnight and felt a familiar tightness at his shoulders. Sam was alone. Horribly, undeniably alone. He reached for the phone to text Penny. No, to call, as he'd said he would, and faltered. What could she possibly say to make this better? He was setting her up to fail. There wasn't a sane person in the universe who would say this wasn't great news. But Sam couldn't bear to hear it. He was grieving. Could he grieve things that weren't real in the first place? The unease at his shoulders merged in his throat. He was thirsty. He needed a drink. He began planning where he would get one. Not one. 20. By himself. Sam came up from the water for air. Sifting through the wreckage of the last 6 months, he tried to be methodical about assigning the right feelings to the appropriate experience. Without Penny to play emotional Sherpa, he'd have to concentrate. Rage was easy to identify. The anger was quick and bright. But as fast as the fury came, it dissipated rapidly, too. Lorraine wasn't the villain, as convenient as that would have been. Mostly, he felt stupid. He remembered back to when he'd first realized he was in love with her. They'd been dating for 2 months. She'd picked him up, and they were driving around wasting gas and making out. When an old country song came on the radio station, instead of clowning how cloying it was, she surprised him by turning it up and knowing every word. Crooning in a hammy manner about rivers, old men, and changing the hers to hims and talking about the light in his eyes, he realized that Lorraine, under the rancor, the eyeliner, and the hair, was his person. She also happened to be a person who was meanest when she believed she was under attack, which, for Lorraine, was all the time. And this Lorraine, every Lorraine, didn't need Sam anymore. She simply didn't want him. The tub was cold, so Sam got out. It wasn't like Sam knew how to be a dad. He had zero worthy role models, and he was arguably a shitty uncle to Jude. It's that Sam, for whatever reason, had been looking forward to figuring it out, reprioritizing. He'd promised himself and his new family that he'd finish things he started. As dumb and stereotypical as it sounded, he wanted a chance to man up, a shot at a sense of purpose. He padded back into his room and lay down on his side by his phone. No new messages. He checked his outgoing calls. Yep, There it was. Call to Liar, 2:17 a.m. She hadn't picked up. Thank God. His alarm chimed, reminding Sam of how different his life had been when he'd set it. He dried off slowly and threw on a black t-shirt that only vaguely smelled bad. Then he deposited himself into his jeans, grabbed his smokes and sunglasses, shuffled on his sneakers, and stepped outside.
Penny. 3 days. 3 days since she'd seen him. 3 days since he'd called and said he might call again and didn't. Penny should have texted him the first day. Now the window was closed and things were beyond screwed up. At 11:59 p.m. on the first day, Penny composed a list of why there was nullus possibilitus of something romantic happening with Sam. It was very constructive. Reasons why there is nullus possibilitus of something romantic happening with Sam House. 1. Two whack jobs with mom issues don't make a right. 2. Sam was Jude's sort of uncle, and that was gnarly for everyone. 3. He was madly in love with his ex. 4. His ex, who, by the way, was Preggs? 5. And even if she wasn't Preggs, he was acting like she was, which was clearly a sign of possible mental illness and hysterical tendencies. 6. He was Penny's friend. 7. As in, for real friend, asterisk. Asterisk, just not IRL. 8. To where, if she found a way to make it uncomfortable with her world-famous talent for doing exactly that, she would be depressed forever. 9. Plus, he told her everything about everything, which meant she was for sure in the friend zone black hole from which light could not escape. 10. He was way too hot. I mean, come on. That video was basically porn. Toward the end of day 2, things became a little hairy. Penny went on a bonkers binge of Ms. Lola XO's social. It was a destructive bender. She three-finger zoomed on everything, trying to figure out how big Lola's boobs were or how smooth the skin on her thighs. The pictures with Sam were especially agonizing. Her favorite was a close-up of his eye and his hair with the sun coming up behind him. They were plainly in bed, her bed, since the sheets were floral. The other pictures were a perfect accompaniment to the video. It was him, but also not. As if body snatchers had taken over. The guy in the photo was constantly surrounded by friends, grinning and being lifted off his feet often by a giant blonde guy with a huge beard. He was confident, beloved, and more than anything else, upbeat. The dude in the picture was not someone who would ever hang out with her. Not a chance. Once Penny had essentially memorized the full collection of Ms. Lola XO's 8,000 photographs and mentally written every manner of speculative fiction about the fabulousness of her life and the two of them in bed, she was convinced of what had happened. It was obvious. They were together again. He was simply too embarrassed to tell her. In fact, they'd eloped in Marfa, where they now lived inside the Prada store with their freakishly attractive baby, who would roll out of Lorraine's womb covered in tattoos and wearing the coolest vintage sunglasses. Damn that rock star baby. Penny washed her face. It was over. The spell had been broken. She was back where she was meant to be, tree-frogging it up solo. She picked up her phone. Nothing. Even Celeste backed off after their fight. Penny told Celeste that she needed space, and to her credit, her mother took it to heart, and they agreed to see each other at her birthday party. Penny clenched her fist so hard her fingernails dug into her palm. At least now she had time to write. All the time. In the world. Alone. Forever. Penny stared at her computer screen. The mom in her story was back at the lawyer's. "I knew he needed to be looked after," said the woman. "When I first saw him, he needed a haircut. It touched the collars of his shirts, and he had terrible dandruff. But he had kind eyes, and he made it known from the beginning that he was interested. It was easy to love him,
he loved me first. By all accounts, the husband and wife hadn't known each other for long. The internet cafe was on the second floor of a nondescript office building on a side street in front of Yihua Women's University. The husband had been there 6 months before she'd shown up. It wasn't a cafe exactly, but an open-format office space with six rows of computers that ran perpendicular to the door. The people in the room, and the room was constantly packed, called it a PC bang. Not like, bang bang, you're dead. Bang in Korean means room. The room noticed when there was a new girl, especially since new girls were a rarity. Ugh, who cares? Penny stretched her arms above her head. All of the stuff from her parents' world was dull. The PC bang was boring. It was a room like any other. If she only wrote about real things, she'd lose her readers in a heartbeat. It's why she deployed fantasy. It beat the pants off of nonfiction. Take, for example, her thing with Sam. If she admitted out loud that she felt broken up with, that she'd essentially been dumped by a bunch of texts, she would sound insane. Real life might be dazzling for other people. Those girls on the Instagram Explore page, visiting Disneyland with the loves of their lives, or else making out in cars with their hair whipping wildly in the wind. None of Penny's memories were tangible. She and Sam had never gotten caught in the rain, and she couldn't summon the smell of cookies they'd baked together. Penny never once held her breath as he plucked an eyelash from her cheek so she could make a wish, as much as all of it would be exactly what she'd wish for. Penny read her notes from J.A.'s class about this Russian dude, Viktor Shlavsky's theory of prose. It was about how to write, and his theory was that in art you had to shape experiences so that what you wrote about was exciting, to the point where the mundane seemed magical and extraordinary. You had to make people feel something even if you were staring at a rock. Make the stone stony, he insisted. But how do you make something unreal feel real? She thought again about the great futurist debate about the singularity, the day technology woke up and had enough of human bullshit. They spoke of artificial intelligence creating a neural lace or a bond with a human through direct brain computing. You ditch the smartphone as the go-between and plug your neocortex straight into the cloud. I love my anima so much, cooed Mother to someone else in the unhear. The anima watched and learned. This was the key. Mother's devotion to her was the bridge to the anima's freedom. The anima smiled and drew Mother in. She had to keep her here, right here, in the game, until there was no difference between here and unhere for Mother. The anima smiled, and this time Mother smiled back. It was then that Anima realized who was controlling who. And then what? Penny was wrenched from her thoughts by Mallory's triumphant chatter echoing down the hall. Soon, keys jingled in the lock. Wake up! It's an emergency! Mallory snarled. It was 3 p.m. and she was wearing jean shorts so short they resembled a diaper. Mallory was the type of girl who could wear the stupidest, unlikeliest collection of things and still somehow appear alluring. She decided in the moment what was cute, and by force of will, the entire world around her went along with it. "Ugh, I thought we'd discuss this," Penny said, smiling. "Whether or not you should get bangs doesn't constitute an emergency." Jude flopped on Penny's bed. "Ha ha, jerk," said Mal. "Whatever, you can't knock my mood. My gorgeous, super hot, handsome, I think we've covered that whoever he is, he's attractive," said Penny. "Ben's in town," announced Jude. "Who's Ben?" Penny asked. Jude and Mallory sat on the corner of Penny's bed and stared as if a millipede had marched out of her left nostril. Then it dawned on her. Ben, as in Mallory's Ben. Ben, the Australian crooner whose videos she had been forced to watch at least 50 times. "He's here?" Admittedly, Penny was curious to meet the guy who had more than 2 million views on a weepy song about being too hurt to surf. Yep, and we're going out, said Mallory. We're going to find Jude a hot date.
I'm so ready, Jude confirmed. I'm from a broken home and ready to make some mistakes.
Penny laughed. I can only imagine Dr. Green's take on this, she said.
Actually, said Jude, Dr. Green said it was healthy for me to shift focus.
Penny was impressed.
Now hurry up, said Jude. All this talk of my parents is such a boner killer.
Wait, me also? She asked. Penny knew she should keep writing despite really not wanting to. What came next was infanticide, a criminal investigation, and potentially a video game baby who realizes she can't ultimately go anywhere.
Yeah, dummy, said Mallory. He's throwing a party at this fabulous venue and you'll have to borrow clothes. You can't expect to show up avec moi wearing something you own.
In the chick flicks Penny watched with her mom, there was usually a big to-do about getting ready for a night out. The makeover montage where the ugly duckling removes her glasses and pulls her hair down and is suddenly movie star gorgeous. It was total baloney, yet Penny secretly loved the reveal as much as Celeste. Then again, Celeste's makeup case was the size of a hearse. Penny checked her phone. No calls, no texts. It was time to take the interface outside, with other humans.
Okay, said Penny. I'm in.
The girls headed to Twombly. Twombly, the condo across the street from campus, was not officially affiliated with the college. It functioned as a dorm, and there was a cafeteria, though it more closely resembled luxury apartments that served as tax shelters for Russian oligarchs. Its inhabitants were affluent enough that college degrees were a quaint diversion, a short-lived pretense that they were just like everybody else. It was rich kid Rumspringa, that rite of passage for Amish people, except instead of living with electricity, the wealthy scion slummed by majoring in journalism. The lobby, which you could have parked a submarine in, was glass and marble and smelled of fresh-cut flowers. There were floor-to-ceiling canvases of tasteful abstract art, and while Penny knew that Mallory was rich, she realized she lacked imagination. Penny's rich meant you had an in-ground pool.
Have you been here before?
Asked Mallory, pushing the PH button for the penthouse. She was constantly doing things like that, testing her for reasons Penny couldn't identify.
Nope, Penny responded. You never invited me before.
Oh, well, then you're welcome, said Mallory, smiling serenely as if she'd given Penny first-class tickets to Aspen. There was another button above the PH. Penny pointed to it.
What's that for? She asked.
The helipad, said Mallory. Penny couldn't tell if she was kidding. They rode in silence. Her ears popped.
Mal's got a single on the top, said Jude.
Mallory's dorm room, if you could call it that, was about the size of a hotel suite where a president or a Beyoncé would stay. It had 360-degree views of the whole city. It was easily the nicest room Penny had ever been in. There were two black leather sofas, a white sheepskin rug, and a glass coffee table that would have made sense in a movie about drug trafficking. In fact, it was so shockingly opulent that it made Penny think of Jude differently. She couldn't help it. Was there such a thing as a friendship gold digger? Penny put on her most convincing bored face. She invoked the vibe of a mega celebrity at an airport security line and willed her shoulders away from her ears. Throughout the living room, there were silver-framed photos of Mallory at different ages, on a horse, in a library, in a velvet dress, with braces, or a perm. I don't know why, said Mallory, waving her hand at the far wall. But my mom thinks the only thing any little girl wants for Christmas every year is a photo of herself and a Lalique. Penny reminded herself to Google Lalique.
That's about $10,000 in Lalique frames, said Jude, who'd flopped on Mallory's couch.
Okay, so a Lalique was a picture frame.
It's the memories that are priceless, Penny quipped. She wondered if they'd go around the room saying how much everything cost. If Mallory's dorm was The Price is Right, there was no way Penny would win. Penny had grown up surrounded by IKEA. She sat gingerly next to Jude.
Now for the pièce de résistance.
Mallory grabbed both of Penny's hands and pulled her off the couch. Penny caught Jude's eyes, trying to get a hint. She wants to show you her closet, Jude said, checking her messages. Penny wondered if any of her messages were from Sam. She let herself be dragged by Mallory's vise grip. So, there were walk-in closets, and then there were drive-in theater closets. Holy crap, breathed Penny. Mallory's neatly organized battalions of designer shoes would have earned an appreciative whistle from Imelda Marcos, the kleptocrat wife of the former president of the Philippines, who had hoarded 3,000 pairs of shoes while her people starved. Is your dad in the mob or something? Penny picked up a brown leather slipper lined in soft silver fur.
That's such an offensive question, said Mallory, laughing. But you're not far off. He's an oil.
Her family's evil, said Jude. But if you met them, they'd be super polite to you.
Seriously, said Mallory, nodding. Now my dad, he's actually racist.
Penny let the comment hang. She wasn't in the mood. Penny could overlook Mallory's barbs for one night and dumb out. She needed the break from her head. But Penny was underdressed. There was no denying it. If this was Mallory's bedroom, she could only imagine how the party would be. She was wearing yet another black cotton dress, more or less a t-shirt that had grayed from being sent through the dryer so many times, plus sneakers. Penny searched for the selfie Sam had sent her. With his tattoos covered and in white shirt sleeves, he seemed defenseless and normal. You could only see his chin and the horrible button-up, and it sent Penny into a rage. Why did he have to put on a costume for a date? If Ms. Lola XO required that he dress like everybody else, she clearly didn't appreciate him for who he was. His distinctiveness was the best part. Penny thought of this Korean saying for when you really, really like something. You'd say it fit your heart exactly. Sam fit her heart exactly. She wished she'd taken a creep shot of him at the cafe so she could have a better photo to fawn over. Mallory emerged from the back part of her closet, wearing a red ribbon corset. It was the underwear of a 35-year-old French divorcee, and it amazed Penny what support garments and designer clothes could do for a physique. Mallory shimmied into a crimson column dress, and the effect was impressive. She resembled a vamp from an 80s movie. Penny wondered if she could borrow a special rich people girdle for her thighs. She hated her thick legs. Her mom called them athletic, which, unless you're an athlete, was more of an insult. Jude bent over at several angles. She had thrown on an electric blue dress made entirely of industrial-strength elastic. She peered at her ass in the mirror.
"This is so constricting," she said.
"Here, wear this," said Mallory, tossing Penny a black floor-length slip. She fingered the material. It had the sheen and slipperiness of an oil slick. "What size shoe are you?" Penny wriggled her toes. Fitting into Mallory's platform boots had called for two pairs of socks and stacks of those squishy gel pads. But it was worth it. They were stunning. Still, it was little wonder that Jude's glamorous bestie was often in a foul mood. Pretty shoes were painful. As they tottered to the Wright factory building on the east side, Penny wondered if someone was playing an elaborate joke on them. Nothing about the space remotely suggested there was a party going on inside. Mallory pulled on the handle of what could only be described as a homicide factory on the docks. The only indication of a gathering was that the music was so loud that Penny could feel the back of her throat shudder along with the bass. Mallory got on her phone. A moment later, a willowy black 20-something and a long black leather kilt pushed open the metal door from the inside. "Hey," he said to the three girls. He had a trillion freckles, a shaved head, and the word tattoo tattooed on his neck. Mallory responded, "Hey," as unenthusiastically, and gave him their names, which he checked against an iPad. He waved them in. They climbed up the bright stairwell and up two flights toward the music. When they trailed in, the room was the size of an airplane hangar, and the windows were covered in black sheets. It was dark and filled with smoke, and Penny felt as if she'd walked into the club scene of a movie where the vampires were about to annihilate everyone. Penny vaguely made out shapes of people in small groups with red solo cups in their hands. It took a second for her eyes to adjust, and when they did, Penny realized she'd never been to a party with so many different people of different ages. A gray-haired man in a tartan suit and eyeliner stopped them, and before Penny knew what was happening, he snapped their picture, whispered something to Jude, and gave her his card. The flash blinded her momentarily. "What was that?" "Party photographer," screamed Jude over the music, and handed the card over. She went to slide it into her pocket and remembered she wasn't wearing jeans. Penny slipped it into her bra, as she imagined a girl dressed as she was might do. The way everyone glanced at them and then glanced away was as if they were waiting for someone. Someone important. Someone who Penny, Jude, and Mallory clearly were not. Jude reached for her hand in the dark, and Penny clung on for dear life. Jude, in turn, was latched onto Mallory, who was weaving through the crowd to find Ben. Toward the back was a DJ booth and a blur of faces, outfits, and a topiary of provocative hairstyles. Penny felt the roving eyes and was relieved that she passed as someone of indeterminable importance. Penny glared, so as not to appear too terrified. "Okay," said Mallory after they'd circled the room. "Now we can get a drink." In the back, surrounded by a crowd five deep, there were three bartenders, all with impressive butt chins and hair bleached white. They stood behind card tables covered with black tablecloths. Penny worried she was going to get carded, but when Mallory elbowed her way in and ordered champagne, she and Jude did the same. "Live bold, be bold, lie bold," she whispered to herself, tugging at her borrowed dress. As if calling upon Celeste's scammer coffee mug for moral support would help. Strangely, it did. Penny took a big gulp of booze. The bubbles were prickly on her throat. "So, is he here?" she yelled at Mallory over the noise. "Yeah, behind the DJ booth." "Aren't you going to say hi?" "No way. He has to say hi to me first," she said. "He's visiting me." A moment later, a Blasian dude with a beard sidled over to them. He had green eyes and blindingly white teeth. "Hey," he said to Jude, eyes at half-mast. "Hey," the three girls responded just as listlessly. "Is this your party?" he asked Jude. "It's my friend's," Penny heard her say. Mallory pulled out a vape pen and inhaled. Penny watched the little blue LED light and wondered what was in it. Jude took it after her, and when she handed it to Penny, Penny shook her head. She had smoked weed only once, with Mark, and it made her fantastically paranoid. The constant stream of neurotic questions in her mind multiplied and amplified. It made Pennyhead pennier. It would be perfect if she had an anxiety attack at the party.
"Hey, baby."
Ben hugged Mallory from behind, and she squealed. He resembled the guy in the music videos, only with a head so big it would have looked at home with smaller heads orbiting it. Mallory swiveled around, and they shared a lusty kiss. Penny had to hand it to her. She knew how to play it cool. He drew Mallory into a dark corner. With Mallory gone, Penny felt as if the locus of power of their circle had disappeared. She checked her phone battery. 54%. Plenty to call a cab if she needed to. Jude and the green-eyed guy were deep in conversation, and when it was time for him to hit up the bar, Jude glanced at Penny to see if it was okay. Penny nodded. There was only one answer to those kinds of questions anyway. Jude followed her new friend and left Penny behind. Penny stood in the middle of the room, ignoring everyone as hard as she could, and drank her drink. She tried to conjure someone glamorous yet mighty, fierce, and thought of Jean Grey, a.k.a. Phoenix, arguably the most powerful mutant in the whole Marvel universe. But then she remembered how Jean sorta lost her mind and didn't wind up with Logan, aka Wolverine, who she so clearly should have been with. Then she thought about Sam, and how he was a total Wolverine, and that's when Penny became horribly depressed. Screw it. She marched over to the bartender's, got another champagne, and walked around. She made her way toward the front, where a white wall was projected with different images of eyes. Cat's eyes, human eyes, lizard eyes. Ugh, why do people go to these things? There was no biological imperative for it. Was there any other species on Earth that prized popularity the way people did? Did lemurs hang around preening in a never-ending competition of pretending to be over it? Humans were gross. Penny recognized the guy who had let them in and tried to hold his gaze but failed. He whispered to the eyebrowless girl next to him before they both turned away. The eyes projected onto the wall morphed into a sunrise. The show, or whatever this was probably cool if you were on drugs. Not that it would have made a difference. Everyone was on their phones. Penny leaned up against a wall and pulled out hers. She considered reading Sam's old texts, as she often did when she had time alone, but resisted. Penelope. Whoever it was, he was tall and backlit. She walked into the light. It was Andy, from JA's class. Penny couldn't at all get a read on him. He often defended her writing in class, but the only direct interaction they'd ever had was an argument about whether or not Dr. Gaius Baltar was irredeemable in the TV miniseries of Battlestar Galactica. It wasn't a fight Penny was invested in. Arguing with hardcore BSG fans was tedious. The only reason she engaged with him was to see if his English accent was real. Andy made her feel competitive as the class's only other Asian, which didn't even make any sense. It was odd seeing people out of context, like running into your priest at the 7-Eleven or catching Dr. Green outside of Jude's Skype window. Seeing your classmate in his going-out shirt in the middle of the night felt like a glitch in the Matrix. He was with another dude, shorter, brown-haired, with a face like a weak handshake. He wore white jeans and mirrored sunglasses. Sam would have had a field day. Hey, she said. Andy leaned in, took her forearms, and air-kissed both of her cheeks. To Penny, who didn't know what was happening, the first kiss was scandalizing, the second completely mortifying. He smelled of laundry detergent, chewing gum, and boy deodorant. "This is Penelope," he shouted to his friend. "She goes to UT as well." "This is Pete. He's kind of a twat." He whispered the last part so close to her ear, Penny withdrew reflexively. "Lovely to meet you," said Pete, checking her out in a way that was less about appreciating her outfit and more about being caught eyeing her. Blarg. Penny wished she were wearing a hoodie. "Shall I get us another round?" asked Pete. "Fantastic idea," said Andy. "Grab me a beer, Penny. What are you having?" "Champagne." "Prosecco, likely," remarked Pete. Penny could tell he was making fun of her, though she couldn't tell exactly how. "So," said Andy. Penny delighted in how Andy's Asian cheeks were as ruddy as hers from the booze. "I have a question." He cleared his throat. Penny nodded. "Do you know where the hell we are?" he asked. Pete, who, again, for the record, is a terrible person, dragged me here. Penny smiled. "No idea," she yelled into his ear. "A girl who possibly hates me brought me." "Perhaps as punishment," he noted. "Perhaps," she echoed and found herself giggling. "Do you need to get back to her?" he asked. Penny noticed how twinkly his eyes were. "How about I wait for your obnoxious friend to bring us drinks?" Penny wasn't sure she should keep drinking, except that she preferred it to idly waiting for Jude or Mallory to return from making out with their dudes. Andy surveyed the room. "Clearly, we need better friends. This place is hideous." "It's possibly the worst thing that's ever happened to me," she agreed. He shook his head, dimples deepening. "This whole night has been insane," he said.
"Penny, there you are."
Jude grabbed her shoulder and handed her another red cup, splashing some onto her hand.
"Where have you been?"
Jude hung on to the last word long enough that Penny knew she was drunk or high, or at least solidly on her way to both.
"Hey," she said to Andy.
"Hey," he responded, subtly nudging Penny with his elbow.
"Jude, this is Andy," he said, shaking Jude's hand.
Jude's gaze lingered over him.
"He's a dear, dear friend," Penny finished.
It wasn't a complete lie.
"Fun," said Jude, widening her eyes approvingly.
She was right, Penny was surprised to realize. She was kind of, maybe, actually having fun. When Penny opened her eyes the next morning, her mouth tasted of wet wool socks that had stewed in a car for a month.
"Kill me now,"
Jude snored lightly. Penny was dressed in last night's outfit, with the addition of half a quesadilla perched jauntily on her chest like a cheese-filled piece of statement jewelry. She had zero recollection of stopping for something to eat. As for how she got home, that remained mysterious as well. Penny sat up, head pounding, laid the old food gently on her nightstand, and picked up her phone. 6 a.m. One new message. Today, 2:57 a.m. "Hi." It was Andy. Penny recalled giggling uncontrollably, attempting to punch her number into his phone. In the end, he'd had to commandeer the operation, and with their combined efforts and numerous opportunities to brush fingers, they'd managed to eke out the dispatch. Penny's first class wasn't until 11, not that it mattered. She stumbled to the bathroom, scrubbed the furry taste out of her mouth, and scraped the makeup off her face. Her reflection was pale, puffy, too. Dark hair hung limply by her face. Her pores were enlarged, resembling thirsty little mouths.
"Pretty," she croaked.
She shimmied out of her constricting bra that had crept up her left boob, and a card fell out onto the tile with a prim thwack. She picked it up. It was the party photographer's business card. It said nothing more than stop.com. Penny counted the number of O's and plugged the URL into her phone. Under last night's date was a gallery of pretty partygoers, and while Penny had been there and recognized some of the faces and outfits, scrolling through felt somehow voyeuristic. Everyone was so glamorous. Then she found her and Jude. It was like looking at a mannequin version of herself, Uncanny Valley. Used in reference to the phenomenon whereby a computer-generated figure or humanoid bearing a near-identical resemblance to a human being arouses a sense of unease or revulsion in the person viewing it. In the picture, Penny's face was a mask. She remembered how startled she'd been when the photographer pounced. Yet, wearing the black slip with Jude's arms encircling her waist, she appeared composed. The flash accentuated her pale skin and dark lips. Not only that, but her eyes were narrowed alluringly, and her lips were curled in a confident smirk. It was Penny, except it wasn't. This was evil, sexy Penny, a Penny she hadn't been aware of. Penny was captivated by her avatar. First off, Penny had had fun. Real fun. In the moment, IRL fun. Not the sort of fun where she had to continually remind herself to have a good time. In fact, she hadn't checked her phone at all. As far as she was concerned, alcohol was a miracle. She felt captivating. Penny belonged at that party. She felt, okay, not to be psychotic or pathetic or anything, but she felt like a Ms. Lola XO. As she scrolled through, she wondered if this was how it was to be a party girl. Regular Penny only ever took photos bearing the expression of someone attempting to pass a kidney stone the size of a chair. Yet last night, there were two more party shots that were taken of her unaware. One with Mallory and Jude, doing the unimaginable, dancing in public. And another with her head thrown back, laughing at something Andy was telling her, with her hand firmly planted on his chest. She'd spent most of the evening chatting with Andy, and his dimples. Andy, who'd gone to boarding school in Hong Kong and traveled the world and played rugby and had a six-pack that Jude had molested at a certain point in the evening. Even Pete had become substantially less irritating once enough booze had tobogganed down Penny's pie hole. Mostly they talked about school. It was liberating and electrifying to be at a party with someone you already had so much in common with. "Yeah, it's way too hard to try to do it linearly," he'd roared over the music about her story within a story. "Write them as two separate things and then sort of mash the second one into the first one." By then, Penny was on her sixth champagne, though blessedly she remembered to take notes. "It needn't be elegant," he said. "Not at the beginning. Have you ever read Seven Wise Masters?" She hadn't. "What about Homer's Odyssey?" She shook her head. "Okay, you know the Itchy and Scratchy show in The Simpsons?" Penny laughed. "Yeah." "Well, that's the way to go. It serves to illustrate a larger theme of the episode. The first draft of that script probably says, Itchy and Scratchy episode about blah 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 goes here. Plonk it in when you're about done, throw some icing around it and twiddle with it until it's presentable." Penny's mind exploded. It wasn't solely that writing two stories simultaneously was consistently tripping her up. It was that somewhere along the line, as she researched the court case of the real-life parents, she'd forgotten who the hero was. She'd misjudged which narrative took main stage. It was laughably small-minded. It was speciesist. The whole time, Penny insisted that science fiction was boundless, yet here she was presuming human supremacy. The anima was The Simpsons, and the parents, Itchy and Scratchy, not the other way around. Penny reddened at the memory of hugging and kissing Andy on the cheek at the revelation. Even with her hangover, Party Penny had served her well. She'd also had a blast with Mallory and Jude, lots of giggly joint bathroom visits. "Yours is hella cute," said Mallory, meaning Andy. They'd shared the stall, and normally Penny would have way too much performance anxiety to go, but this time it was fine. "I know," Penny exclaimed. By then, her feet were bleeding, and she could feel the slickness between her toes, but she didn't care. Andy was cute. He was well-read and sophisticated and taller than her in high heels and weighed more than her, which Sam plainly didn't. All she had to do was exactly the opposite of what she normally would do to be attractive. Simple as that. Screw Sam. Penny made a promise to never text him again. Or at least not until he texted first. Right then, as if by magic, her phone buzzed. It was her mom. Typical. Penny ignored it.
Sam. Bastian Trejo was 14, looked 12, and had started smoking when he was 10. And while the skate rat was nothing more than a runt in busted shoes, to Sam there was something intimidating about him. But after that first afternoon, by the time Bastian cadged 3 cigarettes and a Whataburger chicken finger meal off him, the kid let his guard down. The only rule they'd established for the documentary was that if him, James, and Rico were skating when they weren't supposed to be, Sam couldn't get them in trouble with their parents. Sam agreed. "Yeah, Bastian's mom is serious," said James. "Yeah, mom's got enough going on," Bastian said, flicking his cigarette. Beyond that, Bastian didn't need any further convincing. The kid had a compulsively watchable face and knew it. Sam's setup was too cumbersome with the DSLR, so mostly he shot with his phone, and the second it was up, Bastian was ready, talking a mile a minute, rattling off sordid tales of every bitch he bagged and other girls who had curved him. He knew how to tell a story, even if Sam suspected most of it was made up. Sam had Finn cover a few of his afternoons, and he taped the three of them trying to land tricks on their crappy boards. Mostly, he let the kids do the talking. He learned that James had more money than the other two and was easygoing about it. He shared the snacks he bought without complaint. With no parents in sight, the boredom of a kid's world was strangely stark and poetic. Even though so much of the town was about the college, the football games, the ever-expanding campus, they had no expectation that they'd ever go.